everybody. My name is Brian Quinn. I'm an attorney and the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, which is Pennsylvania's Lawyers Assistance Program. And today I'm going to be giving you an ethics presentation entitled Gambling, the Secret Addiction. I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with Lawyers Assistance Programs, but if you are, that's great. That makes me happy. But if you're not, let me give you a quick idea of what it is that I do and what we do. And I'll probably refer to it again later in the presentation. As I mentioned, I'm from Pennsylvania, and all 50 states have some form of lawyer's assistance program, either an independent program like ours is, or one that's affiliated perhaps with the State Bar Association. But you can access a complete list and directory of all the lawyer's assistance programs in an ABA site that I'm going to provide at the end of this PowerPoint. So we provide free assistance with interventions, free information and literature, free evaluations. I do strongly urge everyone to check the rules of professional conduct in each of your states to find out exactly what the programs in your state can do, cannot do under the guidance of the rules of professional conduct. But just in general, I can tell you that our services are free, confidential, certainly non-judgmental, and you may remain entirely anonymous and still receive services from a lawyer's assistance program. Some states have different rules with respect to the duty to report misconduct. I know of one state, specifically Virginia, that has slightly different rules, but for the most part, once again, check your state's rules. We are not required to report any to a disciplinary board, so it's completely and entirely confidential and anonymous. So I'll get back to some of that in a little bit, but I wanted to tell you what I did. And education really is a big part of all of our roles in the lawyer's assistance field. You know, we don't get too many people that call our helpline. We utilize a 24-hour confidential helpline. Not many people call our helpline, for example, and say, I'm a gambling addict, or I'm calling about a lawyer who I know may be a compulsive gambler. And when I visited a lawyer friend of mine back in 2008 and told him I needed help, he called Pennsylvania's Lawyers Assistance Program and said he was calling for a friend who had just been arrested for his third DUI, driving under the influence charge. You know, my teeth were falling out. I had congestive heart failure. I had alcoholic neuropathy in my legs. Yeah, that was easy to spot. You know, throw in the 20-some empty packets of cocaine that police found in my car for good measure, and there we have it. Or do we? Hopefully this program will help you look below the surface, beyond the obvious, and into the world of the lawyer who is impaired by gambling, the secret addiction. Let's start off by getting a basic idea of what gambling, problem gambling, and some of the symptoms of a gambling disorder or gambling addiction may be. Many of those terms are used interchangeably, and that's where I hope we can hopefully provide you with some guidance, because those terms are as I said, used in many different fashions. So I want to start off with a real simple question. What is gambling? Gambling is defined as any betting or wagering for self or others, whether for money or not, no matter how slight or insignificant, where the outcome is uncertain or depends upon chance or skill. Problem gambling is gambling behavior which causes a disturbance in any major area of life, psychological, physical, or social. It's a progressive addiction. That is, it does not stay the same. It's chronic and progressive in nature. There is an increased preoccupation with gambling, a need to bet more money more frequently. There's a restlessness or an irritability when attempting to stop. And there's a continuation of gambling behavior in spite of mounting serious negative consequences. Then we get into the area of gambling disorder. It's estimated that 2.6% of the population, which is nearly 10 million people in the United States, suffer from some form of gambling disorder. That's a pretty startling subject. Despite the fact that 10 million people, or as I said, 2.6% of our entire population, does suffer from a gambling disorder, gambling was still the proverbial redheaded stepchild of the mental health family. But all of that changed in 2013 when the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is the Bible used by medical professionals to diagnose mental disorders really around the world, finally recognized gambling disorder as the very first non-substance related addiction disorder. And that was really a breakthrough in the field of addiction study and addiction medicine. I want to go over what the DSM, that's the abbreviation for the publication I just mentioned, what the DSM-5 cites as a gambling disorder. As I said, they moved that disorder to the section of the treatise, substance-related and addictive disorders. The rationale for this change was the growing scientific literature on gambling disorder that revealed common elements with substance use disorder. Many scientists and clinicians have long believed that disordered gamblers closely resemble individuals with alcohol and drug problems. So one of the criteria is a persistent and recurring problematic gambling behavior, which leads to clinically significant impairment or distress. Now, the person who is suffering from a gambling disorder must, by definition, exhibit four or more of the following in a 12-month period. And I'm going to go through them, each of the criteria, four or more of these nine criteria. First, a need to gamble with increasing amounts of money in order to achieve the desired excitement. Second, is restless or irritable when attempting to cut down or stop gambling. The third criteria is the person has made repeated unsuccessful efforts to control, cut back, or stop gambling. Fourth, the person is often preoccupied with gambling. In other words, there's a persistent thought of reliving past gambling experiences, handicapping, planning the next venture, thinking of ways to get money with which to gamble. The next criteria is the disordered gambler often gambles when feeling distressed. In other words, when they feel helpless, guilty, anxious, or depressed, they resort to gambling behavior. The next criteria exhibited by someone with a gambling disorder is that after losing money gambling, the person often returns another day to get even. That's referred to as chasing one's losses. Seventh criteria is that the person with a gambling disorder lies to conceal the extent of involvement with gambling. Next, the disordered gambler jeopardizes or loses a significant relationship, job, or educational or career opportunity because of gambling. And last criteria is that the disordered gambler relies on others to provide money to relieve desperate financial situations caused by gambling. That's referred to as a bailout. According to Dr. Charles O'Brien, who's the chair of the substance-related disorders work group for the DSM-5, brain imaging studies and neurochemical tests made a strong case that gambling activates the reward system in much the same way that a drug does. Specifically, they found that cocaine and gambling activate the same portions of the brain, which is quite interesting. Disorder gamblers report cravings and highs in response to their stimulus of choice. And by stimulus of choice, it means the type of gambling that they engage in. Some people are stimulated by the lights, for example, of a machine. Of course, I'm going to get into internet gambling and online gambling because of the change in circumstances due to COVID-19. But it is also, by the way, an addiction that runs in families, often alongside other addictions. And I'm going to discuss what we call co-occurring disorders as well. There are basically four stages of compulsive gambling. The first is the search for action or the winning phase. The second stage is the chase or losing phase. The third stage is the desperation phase. And the final phase is the hopelessness phase. And I'm going to go through those right now. On this next slide, you'll see, if you're following along, the search for action or winning phase. Let's face it. If everybody lost initially, there wouldn't be very many problem gamblers or addicted gamblers. But many gamblers win in the early period of the progression and see that as a product of their personal ability. They're convinced that they're better or smarter, that they've come up with a system. They're convinced they can win big, which will enhance their image of themselves. You know, gambling's still fun and exciting. Losses are just bad luck. Bad weather that day, the referee or the umpire made a bad call, and it'll all be different tomorrow. For others, it's a way to escape from problems or troubled relationships. You know, while they're gambling, all their cares and worries go away. In the next phase, which is the chase or losing phase, continued gambling inevitably leads to increased losses of both money and self-esteem. Let's face it, they don't build those magnificent buildings and casinos if the house always loses. So the continuation of gambling will inevitably lead to an increase in losses. And to regain these, the gambler borrows money and bets on credit. More time spent gambling. Bigger bets are needed to cover losses and repay loans. It's referred to sometimes as doubling up to catch up. Family troubles arise as time spent gambling and debt increases. Absenteeism and job changes are common. Lies and deception result in risk-taking and illegal activity in the losing phase. Then in the desperation phase, the personal and professional reputation of the gambler is negatively impacted. Bailouts become increasingly common. The gambler becomes increasingly alienated from family, friends, and colleagues. The gambler typically experiences a marked increase in the amount of time spent gambling. And the gambler begins to panic in the desperation phase, and they experience deep depression and often turn to illegal acts and other types of desperate behavior. Finally, the hopelessness phase. The gambler becomes obsessed with getting even, paying off debt. Personal, financial, and professional problems multiply. Stealing family and client funds, writing bad checks, and fraudulent loans begin to occur as panic sets in. In the hopelessness phase, there are devastating consequences that can occur as the progression continues, including increased use of alcohol and drugs. Unethical and criminal behavior are very common in this phase, and depression and risk of suicide increases. Gambling addiction has been called the silent or secret addiction because it can go unnoticed for years, despite causing great financial and emotional hardship before anyone realizes there's a problem. Gambling is not something that can be detected by the way a person looks. For the most part, there's no physical characteristics or signs, no evidence from breath, odor, or blood tests. No needle marks or withdrawal symptoms. Gamblers don't overdose and end up in emergency rooms or wrap their cars and themselves around trees or other objects that happen to jump out in front of them, nor do they typically visit a doctor asking for help for their gambling problems. This gives the compulsive gambler a better opportunity to conceal their addiction from family, friends, and colleagues. In fact, they will go to great lengths to hide the issue. However, there are warning signs that can suggest a potential gambling addiction. Later in the program, I will discuss the increased availability of internet gambling, which has really opened up both a Pandora's box of unintended consequences, as well as a variety of disguises for the compulsive gambler's use of a phone or a computer without detection at home or on the job, especially during the many changes created by the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm sure many of you may be familiar with the 20 questions that are used to determine if someone has an alcohol problem. You know, there are a similar set of questions for gambling disorder as well. And the next few slides on this PowerPoint are my version of the 20 questions posed in a slightly different way. So let's discuss some of the warning signs of a possible gambling problem. Some of them are kind of repetitions from the DSM criteria, but these are the ones that the layperson can utilize in determining whether they or someone that they know has a gambling problem or a possible gambling problem, because some of them do have other explanations. Showing an intense interest in gambling-related matters. Failing or at attempts to cut back or stop gambling. Neglecting personal needs or health. Using retirement funds to gamble or cashing in an insurance policy. Suddenly, and the key word is suddenly, needing money or loans. Exhibiting mood swings based on wins or losses. Missing personal or household items. Hiding gambling losses from family members. Being secretive or deceptive when asked about gambling, receiving numerous late notices or telephone calls from creditors, talking only about wins and never about losses, a sudden liquidation of assets. Some more warning signs of a possible gambling problem include gambling to feel good when faced with a crisis at home or in the workplace, gambling to celebrate good fortune, or to mourn bad fortune. Repeated absence from workstations or family activities to use a cell phone in private. Concealing how time is spent away from work or home. And planning special occasions around gambling. And one of the traditional 20 questions asks whether you have ever contemplated or attempted self-harm. Suicide has been mentioned in passing, and I'm going to look at it again when I discuss co-occurring disorders. But people suffering with gambling disorder have the highest rate of suicidal ideation and suicide attempt among individuals with substance use and other addictive disorders. Suicidal ideation among lawyers is already at a rate that far surpasses the non-lawyer population. An ALM Intelligence and Law.com study released in February of 2020 revealed that 18% of attorneys have a suicidal ideation at some point during their careers. The National Institute of Health in 2017 released a study that indicated that 4.3% of all adults had a suicidal ideation during their lifetime. But here, that ALM Law.com study indicated that 18% of lawyers have a suicidal ideation. But when you add to that the findings of the American Psychiatric Association that more than one in two disordered gamblers experience suicidal ideation, more than one in two, and that approximately one in five disordered gamblers attempt suicide, the risk to the lawyer who's impaired by gambling is nothing short of frightening. I didn't come to this job by accident. I suffered from a multitude of disorders, co-occurring disorders, as you will learn.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is GIG. G-I-G. All lowercase. GIG. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is GIG. G-I-G. All lowercase. GIG. Please take a moment and write this down.
To find out that they're called. Yes, as I mentioned in the opening of my presentation today, I reached out for help in 2008 and seemed like a pretty typical case. Arrests for drunk driving, possession of illegal drugs, health and appearance disheveled and in disarray. Add to that the fact that my home was in foreclosure and had gone to sheriff's sale. Likewise, my office building. I was facing imprisonment, which I ultimately did face and for my third drunk driving case, and lost my license to practice law. But what wasn't really known too much about me was that many, many years before some of those symptoms, I had begun to gamble. And in those days, it was illegal. This was before the legalization of gambling. I graduated from law school in 1973. I actually helped finance both my undergraduate and my law school tuitions by selling illegal football pools or engaging in other illegal gambling behaviors, being a runner for bookies and things like that, kind of a subcontractor, so to speak, in the illegal gambling world. But very few people associated that with addiction. It was something, you just couldn't, he just can't control himself. An impulse control problem, professionals used to call it. Not a true addiction, as I've mentioned. It wasn't until 2013 that it is even treated by medical professionals as an addiction. So my gambling habits increased, just like those warning signs, multiple bets, higher amounts were bet, and eventually I had to start to do things like borrow from one person to pay off another. All the shell game I was playing, not only to feed my gambling habit, but my drug habit and my use of alcohol, and the fact that I was basically unable or didn't really care if I worked or not. As long as I could get my hands on money, and unfortunately that also involved stealing money from clients. And that was the point where I realized I was not only an alcoholic, a drug addict, but I was a thief as well, and a licensed Pennsylvania lawyer, and no one knew it. So I did go into recovery, but unlike the type of gambling that I knew from my past experience, the focus is now on legalized forms of gambling. Now, 48 states have some form of legal gambling. The only ones that don't are Hawaii and Utah. 38 states have casinos. Pretty much something most of us take for common, right? But did you know that by 2019, gambling revenues had reached a record high of $43.6 billion? According to the American Gaming Association. Interestingly enough, they released their statistics in June of each year, so it won't be till June that we know what 2020's revenues were, but early reports are that despite the COVID-19 pandemic, gambling revenues in the United States will once again be at a record high for 2020. Pretty interesting. But it wasn't until a case that was decided by the United States Supreme Court that the whole gambling world changed. And that was the case of Murphy versus the NCAA, in which the United States Supreme Court held that sports gambling was now legal in all of the United States, not just in Nevada, of course, subject to state by state legislation. And excuse me, I can tell you that 18 states plus the District of Columbia have legalized and fully operational sports betting. Four additional states authorized sports betting in 2020, and six states have sports betting legislation pending as states start to see the impact on their budgets. And I'll get to that as well in a few minutes. But the world of gambling changed entirely when people could start to bet on sports. What did that mean to states' revenues? You know, interesting enough, you would think, well, Nevada's still the leader. No, it isn't. Both Pennsylvania and New Jersey, for example, far exceed Nevada's gaming revenues, sports gambling revenues, I should say. And that's not a mistake. And as a matter of fact, interestingly enough, there was a CBS News report a few months ago that Philadelphia is apparently poised to become the epicenter of the United States sports betting world, not Las Vegas, once a fabulous new state-of-the-art bar and sports betting establishment palace, actually, is opened by a group led by media giant Barstool Sports and Bullpen Capital. Gotta love those names. So we go from Nevada only to the first casino outside of Nevada, which happened in 1978. That was in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Through the Atlantic City ups and downs, and the impaired gambler wasn't considered to be suffering from an addiction, but rather an impulse control disorder. And yet it wasn't until 2013, as I mentioned it, the DSM-5 recognized gambling as an addiction. So we went from casino gambling environment where, for example, someone would go into a building and play slots in Atlantic City, and that was the only other place. You'd have to interact with a person where you give an employee, let's say, a $10 bill. You'd receive a roll of quarters, have to open them up, put them into a slot, as in slot machine. Use your other hand to pull a lever and watch three wheels spin. Of course, back in those days, you still had to put coins into a payphone. But in the meantime, we didn't treat compulsive gamblers as addicts until 2013. All these years go by after this interaction with people. Now we're at a point where we have a gambling industry that still likes to refer to responsible gaming, and that gambling, as I said, is an impulse control disorder, not a true addiction or a disease. Suddenly, where are we today? We find ourselves able to bet via credits from our phones, able to make a bet every 1.5 seconds, bet on balls and strikes of every baseball game, by the way, with a little touch of your cell phone. And yet these establishments that promote gambling and sell naming rights and partner with professional sports leagues continue to use a 1980 response to a 2020 problem. And speaking of establishments, now we have something that's called the gambling establishment. Which is a partnership between casinos, online operators, sports television, and state governments. And in the United States, it's estimated that public revenue generated directly from gambling represents nearly 3% of state budgets. A lot of money. And, you know, I'm not being critical. I'm not anti-gambling, first of all. But I am for ethical gambling and something a little bit more than responsible gaming. But that's for another conversation. I just want to put it in perspective so that we know that it is a huge industry. Speaking of changes over the years, I'm going to refer to four different quotes from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell on the topic of sports gambling. In 2009, Mr. Goodell said that the negative social impact of gambling cannot be minimized in a community, as he was discussing whether or not legalized sports betting should be allowed in the state of Delaware. In 2012, he said it's a very strongly held view in the NFL that the threat of gambling could be very damaging to the NFL and very difficult to ever recover from. In 2017, he stated, We still strongly oppose legalized sports gambling. The integrity of our game is number one. We will not compromise on that. And in 2020, he said, quote, we think that sports gambling in many ways creates a lot more engagement for our fans, gives them another opportunity to engage with the game. And as I said, that conversation is to be continued. The prevalence rates of alcohol use disorder, substance use disorder, and mental health disorders is disproportionately higher in the legal profession. As you can see from the slide that's entitled ABA / Hazel and Betty Ford study, that's a reference to basically the first scientific study of the use of alcohol, drugs, and mental health issues in the legal profession conducted. And it was conducted by, as I said, the ABA in conjunction with Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation, which is a facility in Minnesota. And it was led by a gentleman named Patrick Krill, who's a lawyer and a certified drug and alcohol counselor. And Krill sent out approximately 13,000 anonymous and confidential questionnaires to licensed attorneys throughout the country who were also employed in some capacity in the legal profession. It didn't matter if they were private practitioners, government lawyers, in-house corporate lawyers, law clerks, it didn't matter. Employed and obviously licensed. And there were 19 states represented in the country by the survey. And he found, as the result of his survey, that his conclusions were incompatible, in his own words, incompatible with a sustainable professional culture. Why did he say that? Well, because he found that 21% of all licensed attorneys suffer from problematic drinking, which he defined as hazardous or possible alcohol dependency, and that 32% of all attorneys under the age of 30 are problem drinkers, not someone who has just one or two too many or on once or twice too often, but problem drinkers who had a possible alcohol dependency. Now, he did ask questions about the use of drugs in our profession, but he only got 3,400 responses of those nearly 13,000 questionnaires. The other 10,000 lawyers, give or take a few, just skipped right over that part of the survey. And it's not, in his Mr. Krill's opinion, because lawyers don't use drugs. It's because they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about their use of drugs, especially illegal drugs. Alcohol's legal. Not to mention socially acceptable, quite socially acceptable in many circles in our profession, but not so with the use of drugs, especially, as I said, illegal drugs. So they just don't want to talk about it at all. They did want to talk about their mental health, I can tell you that. And he found, and keep in mind that he is a certified drug and alcohol counselor who used that DSM criteria when analyzing the responses. He found that 28% of all attorneys suffer from depression, not just being sad or blue on occasion or the normal mood swings that we all experience in life, but people who qualified under the DSM for clinical depression, that 23% of all attorneys suffer from some form of stress disorder, and that 19% of all attorneys suffer from some form of anxiety disorder pre-COVID. This is a 2015 survey. And yes, folks, higher rates than those among younger lawyers. So, with all these statistics, we ask ourselves, how come none of them mention gambling? Well, it is an interesting phenomenon, I suppose, because there is a connection between gambling disorder and some of those ailments that I mentioned, those diseases that I mentioned. The DSM-5 indicates that individuals suffering with gambling disorder have a significantly increased rate of suffering with depression, anxiety, substance use disorders. As a matter of fact, the most frequent are substance use disorders. Alcohol use disorder, 73%. Of those people diagnosed with a compulsive gambling disorder, 73% have a co-occurring disorder involving alcohol use. 38% with a drug disorder, and over 40% with anxiety and or a mood disorder. Co-occurring disorders with the compulsive gambler. Compulsive gambler. Drug users with antisocial personality disorder are 2 times more likely to be gamblers, and the prevalence of problem gambling is 10 times higher, 10 times higher in the substance use population. And interestingly enough, getting back to suicide, 15 to 20% of pathological gamblers report a significant suicide attempt rate. Back in 2013, as I said, when gambling disorder was finally recognized as being related to substance use disorders as a form of addiction, everything really changed, and it became apparent that if you're going to treat people with a gambling addiction, all of their disorders needed to be identified and treated as well. It did not serve anyone to just simply treat their alcoholism. And as I said, the 73% had that as a disorder as well as a gambling disorder. Just treating the alcohol disorder, not the gambling disorder, was not going to be successful. It was not going to be successful. So that was why it was very important that medical professionals started to realize the connection, realize that connection. So it's really vital. The other thing I want to talk about now is the impact of COVID-19. You know, it's difficult to have any meaningful discussion of mental health and substance use disorders without including COVID. Gambling issues are an increasingly worrying reality. People will always find a way to bet. A gambling addiction is not addiction to sport or casino rooms, folks. It's an addiction to gambling. As coronavirus continues, the gambling problem will likely get worse. People who find themselves with nothing to do will turn to betting as a solution. It's important to understand how coronavirus is affecting the betting industry and what's being done to address the issue in these most unusual circumstances. So everything's obviously moving online. Shopping, socializing, jobs are all adapting to the new environment, and the general consensus is that this is a good thing. It also signals a sign of things to come, and whatever our new normal, quote unquote, ends up being, and it really shows that we're capable of adapting to the proposed digital age. But for most industries, this is positive. For gambling, the implications for customers may be disastrous, because gambling is an addiction, and addictive behaviors will do their best to explore every avenue available. While some forms of gambling may have experienced sharp downturns because of the closing of the brick-and-mortar casinos, there are others that are potentially higher in intensity and stakes and or risk of addiction that rose quickly. So the use of the Internet is really involved, and that's why we see a major change in the complexion of gambling and gambling addiction. For some people managing gambling addiction, working from home potentially removes some of the safety nets that may help them in managing their gambling consumption. These include supervision, support from managers and other colleagues, online blocking software, and the demand of work activities. Working from home can induce increased usage of gambling apps or websites, in part because of boredom, which stimulates gambling, but also because social distancing and isolating at home will lead to increases in exposure to advertisements via television, online, and social media. Anyone who watches any sporting event, I'm sure, knows exactly what I'm referring to, and even if you're not watching a sporting event, depending on what you are viewing, either online or on your television. There was evidence of increased use of online casino and slot games during the early months of COVID, which is believed to have been the result of the cancellation or postponement of sporting events. You know, it wasn't for a while. It took several months before sporting events came back without the in-person fans, of course, for the most part. There is a connection between any economic downturn and gambling. Back in 2008, during the global financial crisis, certain forms of gambling like lottery and scratch card purchases increased among those who reported financial difficulties. So during this time of rising unemployment and global economic instability, some are increasingly turning to gambling as a source of income. If one's facing personal financial challenges, gambling can present significant problems. And so it's important for individuals to really be aware that debt is a risk factor for mental health issues and that turning to gambling during this time is not a safe or reliable source of financial support. So financial problems can exacerbate feelings of hopelessness, and that kind of fast tracks people to a very dark place in their lives. So it's really especially important for problem gamblers to pay attention because of the various addictions that are co-occurring with them, alcohol, drugs, etc. Those with a gambling addiction have a very, very high suicide rate, and financial difficulties can also contribute to that. Severe debt will intensify feelings of hopelessness and vulnerability. So we're unfortunately seeing that the crisis in general has and will increase suicide rates. And alcohol use and poor mental health is also a known risk. And we're seeing both of those on the rise as well. So what we're unfortunately seeing here is a toxic mixture, which really can precipitate a wider mental and physical health crisis than what we were already facing. Isolated individuals really represent a dangerously fertile breeding ground for an increase in gambling problems. And if you didn't know it already, I'm going to tell you now that lawyers love to isolate. We certainly like to avoid interaction. It's near the top of the warning signs of an impaired lawyer, and it's so much easier now to pass off as COVID-related safety protocol. You know, most online sports betting is done on mobile phones. So by the time both professional sports resumed and brick-and-mortar establishments reopened, many bettors already felt more comfortable wagering on sports on their phones than going to a casino for traditional games like blackjack, craps, slot machines, etc. So I mentioned state budgets earlier. COVID-19 had a negative impact on state budgetary positions, forcing them to look for new sources of taxes. And that's when you started to see the legalization and the rollout of online forms of gambling, which actually it can be much quicker to accomplish than building brick-and-mortar casinos that are subject to the COVID-19 restrictions as things ebb and flow. You know, boredom, as I mentioned, and I have a slide here called Boredom, Depression, and Anxiety. Few of us are used to spending so many hours day after day in our own homes, cut off from regular outdoor activities, school, health-related classes, even workspaces. You know, many people began feeling bored, anxious, and even depressed. So the pandemic itself led to stress, not only about our health, but also our work and relationships. I do an entire COVID-19 impact on the mental health of attorneys seminar. I can tell you that I started doing it in March, and I get still inundated with requests to present that seminar as well. The pandemic lent to stress not only about our health, as I said, but our work and our relationships. And these feelings, plus a shift of almost all interactions to an online forum, created a perfect storm for susceptibility to clicking onto an online gambling site. So we see a dramatic increase in the number of hours that people have on screens. The screen time has increased. I believe the last time I saw statistics, it was 10.2 hours pre-COVID was the average amount of screen time. It's up, getting closer to a little less than 14 hours a day, according to some surveys. So while swiping the long hours away can help alleviate some of the restlessness and anxiety that comes from being stuck at home, it increases exposure to heavily marketed goods and services, including online gambling. If it seems like, as I said, you've been seeing more ads about online gambling, it's because you have. And for today's purposes, that topic, as I said, will be continued for another discussion. But because it's possible to gamble using credit cards instead of cash, debts can run up extremely quickly before people even realize what's going on. They can wrap their heads around how much is at stake. Plus, it's available 24/7, simple click of our phones or computers are factors into the heightened addiction risks. So, and the other part of online gambling is it's more easily hidden. Far more obvious if you're going to spend hours at a casino or at a racetrack than if you're simply sitting in the corner at your desk or even at a CLE scrolling and clicking. This lack of visibility can mean that others may not see that you need help until the problem has become very serious. Thus, the secret addiction is even more secret now. Even more secret now. Some people feel that anxiety and depression almost makes some gamblers seek out certain types of medication. You've got to think of some of the online forms of gambling and the devices as electronic morphine. Think about this. The addicted gambler's goal is to play, not to win. And I know that may sound odd, but when you get to the point where it's an addiction or a compulsion or a problem even, winning is merely a means to have credits to keep playing. Money is the needle, not the drug, that gives them the feeling that they crave. Money is the way they get the action. So, why are legal professionals at high risk of these kinds of disorders? Why? Well, we're already emotionally detached. We're thinkers, not feelers. We have this conflict-driven adversarial profession where one lawyer's win is another lawyer's loss. The quest to win becomes paramount in our efforts to give our clients the ethical, zealous representation that we're duty-bound to provide to them. We're perfectionists. We're excessively self-reliant. You know, all these traits may be great for a career, but not so great for our mental health. We have high expectations and accountability. Our work-life balance is easily out of kilter, especially with the work-from-home environment. Always on call, problem solvers, all these things add up to, once again, what Krill found 5 or 6 years ago, higher stress, higher anxiety, higher rates of depression than non-lawyers. It's built into what we do. But the harm caused to our profession by the attorney who's impaired by gambling takes on a whole different look about it. Active trust account funds.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is OAK. O-A-K. All lowercase. OAK. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is OAK, O-A-K, all lowercase, OAK. Please take a moment and write this down.
Certainly violations of the rules of professional conduct come into play. Neglecting clients in cases, you know, missing deadlines. Our reputation is harmed. There's more disciplinary board complaints and claims to the Lawyers Fund for Client Security if that is an agency that exists in your particular state, like it does here in Pennsylvania. And that results in higher license fees, which fund programs like ours and insurance premiums, obviously. So there is a significant connection between anxiety and work and anxiety and unethical behavior in the legal profession. Job-related stress is likely to lead to negative coping behaviors. Anxiety has already been shown to lead to worse outcomes in our work. It negatively impacts creativity and productivity. That is anxiety I'm referring to. But more importantly, anxiety triggers feelings of self-threat, which may then increase unethical behavior. So the compared with individuals in a neutral state, the anxious individual is more willing to participate in an unethical action in a hypothetical scenario and to engage in more cheating, for lack of a better word, to make money in situations that require truthful self-report. So you have an experienced anxiety, a perceived self-threat, some form of defensive coping, and ultimately an unethical act. What does that look like? Well, falsifying timesheets, falsifying records, accessing client funds, misusing IOLTA accounts and escrow accounts, acquiring resources from unethical acts to kind of overcome the threat. Many people feel that COVID-19 anxiety in and of itself has been causing anxious individuals to be more willing to participate in unethical actions because of this increase in threat perception that's going on in our society. Needless to say, anxiety increases the risk of developing an alcohol or substance use disorder, as well as a gambling disorder as well. But when lawyers are involved, we see an increase in the connection between gambling disorder and financial crimes. Why? We're in a position of trust. We have access to the funds of others. We're under increased financial pressure, and we have this ability to rationalize it as borrowing, quote unquote. But it's been estimated that up to a third of the people suffering with gambling disorder will commit a financial crime. So the applicability and relevance of those risk factors to the legal profession must not be overlooked. But keeping that all in mind, what keeps lawyers and judges from seeking or accepting the help they so desperately need? We think that there's four major barriers. First and foremost is shame and embarrassment, the stigma. The stigma that surrounds alcoholism, addiction, mental health issues in our society is disproportionately magnified in the legal profession. No one wants to be labeled alcoholic, addict, depressed, addicted. No one. It's labeled. It's all due to the misconceptions that the media or the what we see on television shows, this stigma that it's got to be someone who lives underneath a bridge somewhere. The other barrier of denial that slips in, and I'm not one of them mentality occurs. You know, people rationalize and minimize what's going on in their life. And that's what keeps lawyers from seeking help, this embarrassment and denial and fear that can be overwhelming. And of course, we can't overlook the insidious nature of addiction and mental illness to begin with. Folks, addiction is the only disease known to man that has as its one of its most powerful symptoms the fact that it tells us we don't have it. Heart disease, emphysema. My arthritis does not tell me my knee does not hurt. Addiction, you're okay. You're not one of them. Yet, the yets have to come into play. But more importantly, lawyers are trained to deal with and solve problems. It's difficult for attorneys to seek help because they don't want to admit that they've But complicating this problem further is the last barrier. I call it the conspiracy of silence. It's really called enabling. It's the tendency of the attorneys or judges' peers to indulge in enabling and lighten the normal stresses of our profession. And the key word is normal. It's okay. It's okay to feel that way. So what can you do? That's where a lawyer's assistance program comes into play, because we have this 24-hour confidential helpline. We help assess and evaluate with experienced healthcare professionals. It's really essential to recovery. We will help identify any co-occurring illnesses and make referrals. Some lawyers' assistance programs in this country have medical professionals on staff. We here in Pennsylvania do not, but we do have a huge referral system. You know, we will help develop an appropriate treatment plan, okay? That's what our mission is, to provide a caring peer assistance program to save the lives and restore the health and professional competence of lawyers, judges, members of their families. By the way, there are many programs, including ours in Pennsylvania, that help the family members of lawyers. Don't forget that. It's an expansive definition of the word family, okay? We want to include, not exclude, people that are part of your life. We help law students, okay? We help anybody who's involved or knows someone, is a family member of a lawyer. Keep that in mind. It's very important. So contact a program in your state to find out more about available services. As I said, every state is slightly different. And this exception to the duty to report misconduct is built into the rules of professional conduct of most states, okay? Because the courts in most states realize that providing an exception to the duty to report misconduct encourages lawyers and judges to seek help through our programs. So for the most part, the rules of professional conduct include a provision that states that information gained by a lawyer or judge while participating in an approved lawyer's assistance program is given an exception to the duty to report. Okay? Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. Because you're not going to be able to work it out for yourself. All the questions that we ask ourselves, I'm not a real addict. I'm not a real alcoholic. I've tried to get help, but it didn't work. I don't have money to pay for treatment. How many programs will help you find public or private funding sources? You're not helping anyone. You're preventing them from getting the help they so desperately need. You're preventing if you don't make that call. Resiliency. That's one of the things that hasn't been canceled. Life may not come with a map, but everyone will experience twists and turns, from everyday challenges to traumatic events with more lasting impact, like the death of a loved one, a life-altering accident, a serious illness, a global pandemic. Each change affects people differently, bringing a unique flood of thoughts, strong emotions, and yes, folks, uncertainty. Yet people generally adapt well over time to these situations and stressful parts of their life, in part thanks to resilience. So as much as resilience involves bouncing back from these difficult experiences, it can also involve profound personal growth. It's actually called post-traumatic growth or adversarial growth. So while many of us have had experiences that were certainly painful and difficult, we know that they don't have to determine the outcome of our lives. There are many aspects of our lives we can control and modify and grow with. So to me, that's the role of resilience. We can't effectuate change if we don't take care of ourselves. The pandemic is no different than the loss of cabin pressure that can result on an airplane. What happens? They give you the announcement. In the event of a loss of cabin pressure, oxygen masks will descend. If you're traveling with someone who needs help, what do they tell you to do? Put your own oxygen mask on first. We need to take care of ourselves in this profession, because if we don't take care of ourselves, how are we ever going to take care of our clients, our families, our colleagues? We in the legal profession are traveling this road together. And remember that. Lawyers impact all aspects of society every single day of our lives. Just imagine the impact that an impaired lawyer is having every single day. It's up to us as lawyers. Ask questions of one another that may change someone's life. But more importantly, it's up to each of us to pick up the phone, be at the center of that ripple effect, and make the phone call that may save someone's life. I appreciate the opportunity of being here with you again today. My name is Brian Quinn. I'm the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania. My contact information is included in this PowerPoint. Please, if no matter what state you're in, if you have any questions, call me, call Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, and we will certainly do our best to direct you in the right place in your state. Thank you so much again. Have a wonderful day.